all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Sunny La.
Kwe.
Y.E. Beat Naxil.
Tan She.
Tanek E. Negat Dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Sangila, good day and welcome to Words and Culture, the Haida episodes. I am your host, Chrissy Lane Sinclair, Haida Cree musician and storyteller. On this episode of Words and Culture, I am visiting with Kathiata Hanyul Dikyang, or True Voice, or Christian White. Christian is a master carver whom I've known for a super duper long time. I probably met him as a little kid, as he is married to my powerhouse cousin, Candace Weir. If you've been listening, I often reference the Kuhadane singers as that is their cultural house, which kind of nurtures Masset Haidas with carving, singing, dancing, painting, and you get the point. Any hoodle, Christian is a master carver. It's always a pleasure to sit down with him and hear him explain his work through story colors, seasons, feel. He is a true artist. On this day, I went to the Kuhadane Longhouse to see what he was working on and saw his incredible bentwood feast boxes, which, by the time of this release, can now be seen at the Bill Reid Museum in Vancouver. I asked Christian to introduce himself.
Kethliata Hinodikyang, the Ohadag. My name is Kethliata, means true voice. My English name is Christian White. And we're inside a Kluhadane. Kluhadane is my traditional longhouse. It means canoe people's house. We're here in at the old village of Kayang, and well, Old Masset or Auklage on Haida Gwaii. Yeah. Right now I'm working on a yellow and red cedar bentwood feast dish. It's one of our traditional food trays, I guess. Kind of a rectangular shape. The ends of the box on the narrow ends, the narrow part, is they kind of go up upwards towards the center, and you know, so, and then the middle part, the longer part, it goes down from end to end and then up again. So it has a really nice shape to it. So this is based on the traditional shape feast dishes. We had other shapes also. You know, some carved out of solid wood, out of alder, solid wood hollowed out, and then carved into a shape of an animal crest. And then other longer food trays with usually, you know, designs on each end carved facing upwards, and then kind of a long curved shape to it. But these ones are, you know, would be used in when a feast was going on or a potlatch. And each of the chiefs would have one of these. At the end of the feast, they would be refilled with more food again, and then they would take these home to their families in their own houses. About 2 years ago, August 20th, 2022, we gifted many of these to the elders and dignitaries at our family's totem pole raising here in front of Kluhadane. So it's really neat to do some more of these types of feast dishes. Plus, we keep the local craftsmen busy creating the chest, little small chests and boxes, and which we paint.
On Haida Gwaii, one of our most treasured resources is cedar. Cedar is used to create items for everyday use, as well as art and ceremonial items.
Well, the bentwood box, it's a technology that was developed by our ancestors. And because we didn't have pottery, we had, so all of our technology was based on wood from, you know, thousands of years ago. You know, they would specialize in, you know, cutting down trees and processing it and splitting the planks. They would use wedges and hammers to split planks off, you know, they'd square off each end of the log and then they would do a line across it and then split along that line. And then they would be able to split a long, long plank off of it, really straight and flat. They would have to be very selective in what trees they chose for that. You know, because, of course, there was no saws back in those days. Everything was done by splitting to shape and using adzes to flatten any irregularities. So it would take quite some time to get it nice and flat. And then they would have it nice and squared off. And they would mark out where the corners were going to be. There would be three grooves carved into the wood. And they were carved very specially, so when the cedar is steamed and bent, it would fold together very tightly, and then, you know, it would create a 90-degree corner. But the fibers would kind of wrap around the outside of the corner. What fibers that are left, it would be carved very thin on the corners, and then in a specialized cut, and then folded when it was steamed. And so then it was joined on the final corner with kind of a lap joint. And so that was either drilled and then stitched together with spruce roots, or else, in this case, using dowels. So wooden dowels, you know, just like nails would be used. And then the box would be fitted, or the bottom part. A lot of the times, say this is made out of yellow cedar sides, and then the bottom is made out of red cedar. And so that was done even way back in the old days. The red cedar was preferred for the bottom piece. And then that would be carefully fitted and then also drilled and then either lashed on with spruce root or else pegged on with yellow cedar pegs. They would be basically waterproof. So if there was a soup in there, and then it wouldn't leak out the bottom or any other, the foods would stay in there, it would be watertight. So, yes, it takes a lot of sanding and preparation. And then I did these fancy cuts on the top to give it that nice undulating shape. And like all of our objects, our useful objects in a household were painted and carved with designs. And so these particular designs, are very hard to decipher. Basically, it is many different elements put together in all different directions. There's some elements that look like, bird heads. There's some that look like claw. Or a body or a wing or a tail, very highly stylized. You know, the ovoid shapes, the U shapes, and the split shapes are the main elements we use. And then we could make any manner of designs. We have human-looking faces on there also. But it's all done with the U shapes and the ovoid shapes and the split shapes. So, black and red are our most traditional colors, but we do have other traditional colors, several other colors that we use, such as yellow, blue, and white. Yeah, and the blue is more of a bluish green. You know, it could vary, you know, from a kind of a light blue to a bluish green color. And so back in the old days, those paints would be made out of pigments. So ground stone, then added with a binder of salmon egg oil. Nowadays, we use mainly acrylic paint, just because of the ease of use and the variation of colors. you know, so we could spend more of the time on the artwork. Like, I am interested in using pigments, and I have used them on some objects, ceremonial objects. So I interpreted the designs as Sinks-Anoe, the seasons of Sinks-Anoe. So Sinks-Anoe is known as the, in one translation, was the power of the shining heavens. He's featured in a story.
They all have a different shade of red.
Yeah, well, that's why I call it the four seasons of Sinks-Anoe. Just to you know, because there's four of them, and then just have that variation of color, you know, make them all individual too at the same time. So
I think about these shades of red often. If he didn't point it out, I don't think I would have noticed or had never known the backstory. It was so subtle and so huge at the same time. I wanted to know more about Christian and how he became an artist. Became? Something tells me he was born into this.
I've been an artist all my life, close to 50 years. Some of my earliest pieces go back to 1974. I was born in 1962. I've had a long career. In the past several years, I've mainly dedicated myself to teaching younger people traditional Haida art. I am a traditionalist. I was taught by my late father, Chief Idansu, Morris White. He taught me to carve at a very young age. I was helping him out, cutting out his argillite carvings, his copper and silver carvings that he made into medallions, rings, bracelets, earrings. And so, of course, my brothers and I, we were drawn right to that that trade, really. And so we've been all artists for most of our lives. You know, I was more of a commercial artist. I was doing all my work to sell to collectors, to museums, to gift shops and galleries. And so there was very little left in our community. And so once I carved my father his chieftainship pole in 1995, and then I realized that there was more to life than just selling all our work to other places, to, you know, we needed more in our community. And my father had created canoes, red cedar, ocean-going canoes, and I worked with him on those, along with my brothers and our friends. And so when my father passed away in 1997, and then I decided to continue that, training young people in carving. And so I've been doing that for over 25 years now. At the same time as having a career. And so I've got to balance the two because most of my livelihood comes from selling my artwork. And so I hope to have these in a gallery exhibition in the near future. And we'll see what the response is. I want to have a whole variety of things. You know, the bentwood feast dishes, bentwood boxes and bentwood chests would kind of be the bulk of the exhibition, but also my argillite carving. I've been carving argillite for 50 years, and I make sculptures which are could be, you know, the size, you know, fit into my hand, or else they could be a little larger, up to say a foot tall or so, but they are a lot smaller and very. There's a, you know, a lot fewer people that get to see those objects. Totem poles, I carve monumental totem poles, but also smaller totem poles ranging anywhere from 6 feet to 10 feet or 12 feet tall. You know, like I greatly appreciate, you know, like people that really enjoy our art. And we have to keep going, really. This is how I stay in the culture is by carving. This is how I practice my culture, is through my carving and by teaching the next generation. So mainly I've done sculpture, totem poles and argillite sculpture. I've also done some jewelry. And, you know, it's been many years since I've really been fully involved with jewelry. My brothers both carve jewelry, silver and gold. Todd and Derek White. And so my sisters are weavers. So it's, and then the younger generation, my nephews and nieces and young friends that are working in the arts, mainly in wood carving. We didn't have very much wood carvers here back in the, even the 90s. Now we have quite a bit more that are taking up the trade. And so it's really good to see new masks coming out in the ceremonies, and then just all what you see online with the younger generation. Many of them have to live in the city. You know, that's where their market is for their artwork. And so they live in the city for opportunities and education. But, you know, what they always know where home is when they come back here to participate in the ceremonial part of our lives.
From the first time I stepped foot on Haida Gwaii, the language has always called to me. But as an artist, it hits different. As I'm pretty new when it comes to speaking Haida or Haud Kil, I asked Christian if he had any advice for learning the language.
First thing is to get involved. Get involved with your community. Look for resources. You know, like resources don't just come to you. You have to look for them. You have to seek them out. Here in Old Mass, we have Haud Kil Ne, and they can arrange courses for people to take on Zoom and live classes. And then there's presentations. There's dinners, presentations. So you got to get in the loop, really, of all the different events that are going on. Usually there's annual gatherings of people to bring everybody together, you know, either here in Old Mass at Auklige or also Llagilda, Skidigit, and also in Alaska. You know, there's First Peoples Cultural Council, where there's different online resources that could be accessed. I know for the Skidigit Haida language, there's a language app on there. Of course, you know, the Skidigit Haida is a dialect, just like the Masset or the Auklige dialect. Haud Kil is, we have our own dialect. They have the same root words, but there's different prefixes and the suffixes. You know, and some of the words are different, but you know, much of it's the same. You know, it's the same language, and just like the Kais Hadi Kil, which is the Alaskan Haida dialect. And you know, we have, of course, some of our last elders in Alaska that actually speak the Auklige Haud Kil, but you know, the elders can speak amongst each other also. But yeah, it's really it's up to the younger generation to step forward and to step up. It's really good to see that because there is younger people doing that. And I think we have to think about taking it to a level of excellence, really. Just like the art, you know, it's like a friendly competition. We have to think about it that way. You know, we're all on each other's side. But at the same time, it's good to have that push, that drive to excel, really. And you see, it's not only about the marks, though. It's not about, you know, the accolades. You know, it's about what you want for yourself, really, you know, for your own pride and your own, like, our people, you know, would strive for perfection, I guess. And I think that's something that we have to remind ourselves to do once in a while, is to strive for that perfection and never give up. Yeah.
I've been asking people if you have a favorite Haida word or something you think is neat, and it's been really interesting. Do you?
There's many, many favorites, really. Like my favorite this summer was Klue Kwias, Klue Kwias, the beloved canoe. That was our main project we were working on for the last 2 years. We created a 51.5-foot Haida canoe out of Western red cedar, Ch'u, we call it, the red cedar. And also there's, you know, yellow cedar, Sathlung. But yeah, Klue Kwias is, like there's just so much in Hodkill. Of course, we have to say, we say Waha, Waha. It just means a, for kind of, for heaven's sakes, I guess, or whatever. But, you know, like there's many different things. Of course, we always say Hau'a. And like to me, Hau'a, and it's actually, it's an expression. It doesn't actually, you know, if I dissect the word, it doesn't really say I thank you or anything like that. So it's an expression. Like if I'm actually going to thank you, I say Dung Ath Kilagn. Dung Ath me. Kill words la gung presently, so it means for you I'm saying good words for you now or whatever. Dung Ath Kilagn. But hau'a is like aloha, I guess. Aloha in Hawaii it would be. An expression. We could say, you know, as even as a greeting, I could say hau'a, you know. But it's usually used for thank you. Yeah, hau'a. But and it's not hau'a, it's hau'a. And so it's there's a bit of a rise in the hau part, and then it kind of subtly goes down. Hau'a. I remember hearing when I was younger, my father talking about Hodkill, and he would say, it's almost like listening to poetry when people are talking. Somebody who's good at it, you know, it'll be coming out like poetry, something that we have to strive for. But you know, it's one of the most complicated language actually in the world, really. So a lot of people, when they first start learning Hodkill, they put the words together backwards because they're so used to English. But people that know Hodkill, we say English is backwards. And so, it's just that the way our language works is the verb is always on the end of the sentence. And there could be two verbs in a sentence.
As my visit comes to an end with Christian, I'm thinking about how I have kind of forgotten how tough we are as Haidas and my family line that I come from. I mean, I just can't all do around whining. There is perfection to achieve. Alju, I think, is also one of my favorite words in Hodkill. Like, it kind of translates to, like, oh, you poor thing. But, like, everything in Hodkill is deeper than that. It's like, when somebody goes, Alju, it kind of feels like a hug. And it makes you feel better just to be acknowledged as just being that poor. And that said, then Christian surprises me and says he wants to share a song he has written for the potlatch that honored the canoe, or Kwias, in Hodkill. Kwias was launched in August 2023. I was lucky enough to be there. Here it is.
Hope I could sing it as good as when I sang it on my walk yesterday.
Glue quick, we ask, holly, I ho, ho.
Haleiha, haleiho, ho, 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 ye. Haleiha, haleiho, haleiha, haleiho, ho, 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 ye. Haleiha, haleiho, ho. Kuequeas, hallelujah ho, Kuequeas, hallelujah ho, ho 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 yeah, hallelujah ha, hallelujah ho, ho 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 yeah, hallelujah ha, hallelujah ho, hallelujah ha.
Beautiful, and I'm so happy we have one more potlatch song. I'm pretty excited not only to have taken in Christian's words and witnessed his art, but to move forward with my journey. As always, howa to my guests and howa for listening. Be all the shades of red.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Maltus.
Ninuis Ahaha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachu Nautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. While an electric vehicle is sitting idle in a garage or parking lot, its battery could still be hard at work, feeding energy to homes or the power grid.
It really just makes that battery useful in another way to add some resiliency to your building, add another energy source, and also an economic stream for you.
Rachel Ackerman of the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center explains that so-called bidirectional chargers allow energy to flow between an EV battery and the grid in both directions. So the battery can charge when demand for energy is low and rates are cheap, like in the middle of the night. That energy can then be fed back to the grid at times when demand and rates are high. That could save homeowners money and help utilities avoid the need to turn on backup power plants to meet peak demand.
We can reduce the use of power plants that emit dirty emissions into the air.
In Massachusetts, Ackerman's group is leading a pilot project that will install 100 free bidirectional chargers for electric cars, school buses, and trucks. The goal is to identify and resolve any barriers to deploying the technology on a larger scale, so consumers and utilities across the country can make fuller use of EV batteries. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.